Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hello, Tim.
Mike, Friday afternoon, late July. I think it's like a million degrees out.
Yes, it is. It is a hot, we have a hot summer in the DC area. And I think the topic we're going to get into today is some sort of developments in the Chinese foreign ministry.
Right. We're not the only ones in hot water, apparently. So yeah, we're going to talk about Qinggang, who was until a couple of days ago the Chinese foreign minister, and who was last seen in public on June 25th, I believe, and what's happened to him, sort of what the rumors are that are out there, sort of about what's happened to him, and kind of what it all means for the United States and for sort of people doing business in China. So with that, we should probably just get to it.
Yeah, I think let's dive in on that. I'd say to our listeners, one of the reasons we were waiting a little to get into this topic is that initially, I think, and Tim can correct me, the explanations were that he was ill and, you know, disappearing from public eye. Maybe a short period isn't that common. I think even Xi had some periods where he disappeared, and it turned out it wasn't anything nefarious. He just, there were certain periods where he hadn't shown up, and then he showed up. But after like 30 plus days now, because we're recording this in July, it's a long absence, and there's a little more information. So what happened, Tim, and like, what do we know today?
Right. So the last public appearance that Xi had was on June 25th, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. And since then, he has canceled or sort of had stand-ins for a succession of appearances. The one that sort of really caught the attention of journalists in the U.S. and in Europe was when he pulled the plug on a meeting with the EU foreign policy advisor, Joseph Borrell. And I think that was a little bit after July 4th. And at that point, the belief was that he might have fallen victim to the second wave of COVID that had been sweeping through China through the May, June timeframe, and just needed some time to recover. But as sort of, you know, 1 week became two, became three, became four, and he was still not being seen in public. He was being replaced by Wang Yi in these meetings, who is actually not only his superior, but had been the foreign minister right before Qinggang. And so people were wondering what had happened to him. And finally, earlier this week, I guess it's now the 28th, so this would have been about the 25th, it was announced in Beijing that he was no longer the foreign minister and had indeed been replaced by Wang Yi, his predecessor. No explanation has been given for why this is. So in the world, there's no lot to wonder.
And Tim, before we go further into sort of what we've heard, can you sort of explain to our listeners sort of, I guess I put it this way, that like job titles within the government don't necessarily always reflect who really has the power in a given topic, because ultimately the power is with the party. So in this context, I believe he was very close to Xi and considered a protege, so kind of was on an upward trajectory. So this is almost more surprising. Would you comment on that too?
So yes, Xi Jinping had worked in the past with Qinggang, and it is widely believed that he had sort of taken a shine to the younger man and had enabled his fast-track promotion through a number of positions, including ambassador to the United States, and then after that as foreign minister. Is that somewhat unusual? Absolutely. You know, China has a fairly hierarchical power structure in which people are expected to climb the various rungs of the ladder, and it is somewhat unusual for someone to be promoted ahead of other people. Having said that, you know, there, it's not completely unprecedented. So if you'd like, why don't we talk a little bit about what we think may have happened, you know, what some of the rumors are. So there has been a rumor that has been floating around for several months now, actually, that I think she may have been Hong Kong-based TV presenter for a broadcast channel called Phoenix TV, had a relationship with Ching Gong, and actually was the mother of a child of his who had been born in the United States. And so that's the rumor. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, mostly in the form of social media posts by this journalist, in which she has a picture of her son and posts, "Happy birthday, Daddy." And it just so happens to be Ching Gong's birthday. Apparently was one of them. And also the fact that the birth of the child sort of took place approximately 9 months, if you will, after an interview that she had done with Ching Gong here in Washington while he was the ambassador in the United States. And so, you know, there's some belief, there's been a lot of internet speculation, and frankly, some, I think, informed speculation that this story is probably true, and that, you know, and that because of that, he sort of has run afoul of the party's Central Committee for Discipline and Inspection, which is looking into his case, and has, in the, you know, while it is going through a longer investigation, has removed Chan from his foreign ministry post. Mostly because I think it's such a front-facing and prominent position within the Chinese government, even if it's not particularly powerful, actually, within the Chinese system.
And does he still have other positions? I believe, and it's not uncommon for party members to hold multiple roles. So are you saying that sort of like this is maybe the most forward-facing position, but that's the only thing we've heard he's been removed from? Does he hold other positions still?
Yeah, he's the state counselor and then may hold other positions within the party. He's currently still listed as holding those. And also, interestingly enough, the day that he was announced as having been replaced on the foreign ministry, the foreign ministry website essentially scrubbed all references to him from the ministry website. However, he remained visible in other Chinese official websites. And then actually yesterday, the 27th of July, the references to his past meetings as foreign minister started to reappear on the Chinese foreign ministry website. So he's sort of gone, but has not gone through sort of this whole erasure purge that may, you know, at some point be following if the inspection turns up behavior that is not in keeping with the party's expectation.
So you said that he'd missed, or maybe this was the most sort of high profile situation where his absence was noted, was a meeting, I guess, with the EU or the commissioner with the EU. But what are the reactions sort of across, you know, I guess, diplomatic offices, you know, sort of across the globe about what's just happened recently?
So I think there's a lot of uncertainty out there. This is not just some country. This is the world's second most powerful country, you know, second most powerful military, and an important player on the global stage. And to have had the foreign minister essentially disappear from sight without any credible explanation for a month is really quite unusual. And you and I were talking a little bit before we started recording this about, you know, what this says about the Chinese penchant for secrecy and opacity. And it says quite a lot, which is that they're sort of willing to endure the costs, if you will, you know, the uncertainty in the international community in order to protect their secrets. And that's been kind of a hallmark of the system since 1949. And I think that if anything, Xi Jinping has doubled down on that. If you look at any number of laws that have been enacted during his tenure of General Secretary and President, from the 2017 intelligence law to the counter-espionage law revision that went into effect at the beginning of July. There is clearly a desire to exercise absolute and complete control over the information flow emanating from China, whether in the public or the private sphere. What that's done is it allows, you know, the rumor mill to run right. And there's a couple of rumors now that are actually really interesting because they sort of speak to the level of, I guess, paranoia and perhaps mirror imaging that's going on inside, you know, both the United States and China. So there have been some reports on some websites that sort of follow intelligence activities that indicate that, at least to some, that Qin Gang may not have been a diplomat, and his early career path indicates that he actually may have been an officer in the Ministry of State Security under diplomatic cover. So that's one rumor. And then, of course, in China, there are rumors that the Phoenix TV presenter may have been a U.S. or British intelligence agent and had, you know, essentially honey trapped Qin Gang, and, you know, who knows what she was getting into double.
So that sounds like, you know, it's almost like a movie plot, right? I mean, sometimes the business of intelligence and national security work is sort of more, I guess I'd say, more run of the mill. This sounds a little complicated, and I think it'll take time before any more information even comes out. I guess it's still interesting to note that, you know, he's not, as you said, not completely like erased from, you know, his historical presence on like the Foreign Ministry website and may still hold some other positions. But the point you hit on earlier that we talked about, you know, before the show is sort of the uncertainty this creates when situations like this happen. And I think, and you have, you know, could probably recollect the scenarios more than I have, but it's strangely not uncommon, I guess, that some officials will disappear. And we have private citizens too, like, you know, founder of Alibaba and others like that. That's happened within China as well. That's all part of sort of the culture of secrecy. But flip that around to the US side, we've had a prior episode about classified information and leaks, and there's been a lot in the news in the United States about classified information getting out, you know, when it shouldn't have. And that's, I think, sort of triggering probably some discussions about what about overclassification? You know, what are we doing with our secrets? But in general, even though there are reasons we keep things secret in the United States and with our allied countries, there's the counterbalance of sort of open discussion about, you know, national security and military objectives. A lot of, we talked about this in terms of national strategies and reports and things, unclassified versions of strategies and studies and those things, you know, all go out there. And sometimes those are to signal things to the congressional leadership or to the public, but also to other countries like China, where there may be a classified annex behind the scenes. But this particular scenario of like somebody who is in your governmental structure, and again, ultimately the party really controls everything. And I understand the position you have in a ministry is not necessarily indicative of the real power you might hold, but for the rest of the world, it would be very unusual for a situation like this to happen, no matter how sort of uptight you are on your national security secrets, to have a minister in a diplomatic, the most senior diplomatic post, I guess, at least in our view. Like if this had happened to Secretary of State Blinken in the United States, where he just vanished for 30 days, that would be unheard of. And it creates a huge ripple effect, I think, across the diplomatic community. And as you already pointed out, sounds like to some extent the party, when weighing the alternatives, doesn't care. It's more important in their view to maintain tight control and deal with whatever's going on here than to have a foreign minister still be in his post state, or I guess even like maybe be more upfront if he was really sick or not, because I think that was sort of sat for many weeks, right? As opposed to they're in the hospital, they're getting treated, like that would be more upfront for another, you know, minister of state in some other country.
And there is still, or as of earlier this week, there was a rumor floating around on the Chinese internet that he had died in a PLA military hospital in Beijing. but there's nothing to substantiate that. But the point you bring up earlier about, you know, the public-facing strategy and other documents that we have, I mean, this is from a sort of military political standpoint. We do that because it enhances global stability. Everybody knows where we stand, basically, and they know generally within general sort of ballpark terms kind of what we have and what we intend to do with it and how we would do that. And sort of, you know, what we see as our red lines. And we generally don't have that same kind of information out of the Chinese. And they kind of like it that way. They believe that uncertainty and keeping us on our toes, you know, is a strategic advantage for them. And we have to kind of navigate that road. The other place where this kind of comes into play, obviously, and this is far more sort of relevant perhaps to the firm's clients, it is that, you know, they're having to navigate the same kind of constrained information environment, you know, in terms of doing business in China. And so some of the same enhanced penchant for secrecy, you know, and a sort of a real willingness to be confrontational has spilled over into other deals. And obviously that makes it more challenging for people to do business there. And if you look at sort of the FDI levels into China, you know, they've dropped somewhat precipitously. And, you know, that's due to a lot of causes, but I have to think that sort of the geopolitical environment is a big one.
And I wonder if on that angle a little bit, if we could comment on the national security law that I think was either expanded in the beginning of July. I wonder if you got some comments on that.
Well, there's a counter-espionage law that went into effect. It was expanded earlier this spring. I think there was a meeting at the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress that ratified that sometime in June. And then it went into effect on the 1st of July. And essentially, that has made the potential universe of state secrets almost limitless. And so that has really contributed to the climate of uncertainty that if you remember that there were a bunch of raids against Bain, Mintz, and some other sort of due diligence and other Western firms operating in China. There was a Japanese pharmaceutical executive on the move who was arrested earlier this year. And so right now, you know, when you are trying to operate in an area where you don't really know what the lines are, you're constrained from asking any questions. And if you're constrained from asking any questions, you're either going to stumble into potentially bad deals, or if you're, you know, like most Western business people, you're not going to do the deal at all. You'll walk away. And so I think, you know, you're seeing some of that probably playing out.
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back to maybe an overarching theme here we're talking about is sort of the culture of secrecy, and the party is making decisions. There are trade-offs here, right? Uncertainty, I think, but both these areas, right? Like the external facing uncertainty that's created when you remove a minister, as well as sort of, you know, uncertainty here about whether or not you're going to get a knock on the door if you're a firm operating within the country because of the expanded counter-espionage law. They kind of go together, and the parties made the decision that they would rather have this strong, you know, handhold of security here than the alternatives, you know, that even though the alternatives might bring in more business, I think, into the country maybe, but that's sort of their decision. That's their trade-off. So any other, I think, sort of final comments on where we think this might be going next? We may or may not get more information on the status of the former minister here, but, you know, who knows?
So I think that at some point, there's going to be some statement sort of wrapping all of this up and giving some indication as to what his whereabouts in the future are. But I think that that's probably not in the offing in the future. I also think, and this has been widely speculated on, that Wang Yi's tenure as foreign minister is likely to be temporary, and that he actually sits in a party position that is above the foreign ministry. So to some extent, He's more of a national security advisor. He's sort of a Jake Sullivan counterpart, if you will. And Jim Gong is more of a Tony Blinken. And so right now he's dual hatted, sort of a la Henry Kissinger back in the 1970s. But I think there's some expectation that they're going to put somebody else back in the foreign ministry slot. Interesting times. And hopefully at some point in the not too distant future, we will get colleagues to join us to give sort of a view of a region.
Yeah, I think this is kind of the precursor to setting up that next discussion. So to our listeners, we're gonna come back to this, and we're going to bring in some of our colleagues from that part of the globe. There'll be more developments to talk about at that point. So until next time, I thank them.
Stay cool, Mike.
Yeah, everyone stay cool. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.